Welcome everybody to a special web chat here, actually at the Washington Convention Center in Washington, D.C. We're not in our usual spot at the White House because there's a pretty big event that's happening here right now, the Nuclear Security Summit. And I'm joined today by Ben Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor, to answer your questions and talk a little bit about what's happened here in the last 2 days and also sort of the week we've had on the issue generally. So before we dive in, I'm just going to ask a question we got in earlier that I think is broad enough for you to sort of dig into a couple things. It actually comes from one of the White House correspondents, Mark Noller from CBS Radio, who posted a picture of all of the leaders today, a group photo, and asked the question, though the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up, why are these men smiling? So can you talk a little bit about the good and the bad here?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Macon, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. It's a good question, of course. First of all, I believe Mark Noller is quoting the president saying the risk of nuclear attack has gone up. And what the president was referring to, and he said this in his Prague speech and he said it this morning, is that the irony of the 21st century really is that with the end of the Cold War, the risk of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, of course, has significantly gone down. So what we normally worried about in the nuclear age, which was a nuclear war between states, that threat has been mitigated in many respects. But as terrorist groups have proliferated and have made known their intention to try to acquire a nuclear weapon, the risk of an attack with a nuclear weapon has actually gone up because terrorist groups, unlike states, cannot be deterred from using nuclear weapons. So that's why the president felt it was so fundamentally important as a priority for the United States of America to lead a global effort to secure nuclear materials so that they can't fall into the hands of terrorists. Because what you have is a lot of materials around the world, chiefly high enriched uranium and plutonium, that are in many instances not as secure as they should be. And what we want to do is galvanize collective action to secure these materials, to lock them down, so that within the next 4 years, which is the goal the president has set, they will be at a level of security that they cannot fall into the wrong hands, that they cannot be acquired, purchased, stolen by terrorist groups who would use them. So that's the fundamental premise of this summit, that this is the greatest threat to American national security, and that therefore we need to lead with a sense of urgency a global effort to secure these nuclear materials. So it's obviously a grave threat. I believe that, however, the leaders here today do feel very positive about the summit, which may get to the question that Mark asked as to why they're smiling. Apart from it being a picture, I believe that there's a feeling here that for the first time, really, since this threat has emerged, there's a sense of collective action and momentum that is embodied both in the fact that all the nations here today have signed on to the president's goal of securing these materials. There'll be both a communique that captures that commitment and also a specific work plan where the nations will sign on to a series of steps that they will take collectively to pursue that four-year goal. And then below that, what we're seeing is a number of very important and specific commitments by individual nations to take action in pursuit of this goal. So for instance, yesterday we saw Ukraine, which of course is a former Soviet republic that has a substantial amount of high-enriched uranium, that they've agreed to transfer that high-enriched uranium out of their country to help secure it so that, of course, it can't fall into the wrong hands. That's just one illustration of a whole range of national commitments that will be made as it relates to getting rid of high-enriched uranium, enhancing greater nuclear security measures, investing in best practices, signing on to international agreements and efforts to secure these materials. So I think there's a sense of very positive momentum here of concrete action so that going forward we can reach the president's goal of preventing that nuclear attack that is mentioned in the question.
Great. And before we take the next question, I should point out you can actually ask questions. Head over to facebook.com/White House, or if you're on Twitter, we're actually taking questions through my Twitter handle, which is @Macon44. We're keeping our eye on it and pulling some out. And the next one actually touches on not just the summit here, but also the START Treaty, which you were just in Prague to handle with the president. And Chris Bowen on Facebook asks, Reagan was the first to sign agreements to reduce nukes. So why do we still have them? Why does Russia still have them?
That's a great question. And of course, what we saw over the course of the Cold War was, for many, many years, the United States and the Soviet Union were building up their arsenals and had many, many, many thousands of nuclear weapons. That trajectory started to shift, in particular around the time that the questioner points out, towards the end of the Cold War under Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan actually also articulated a goal that President Obama has very much associated himself with which is working for a goal of a world that eliminates all nuclear weapons. But we also recognize that it's going to take time to achieve that goal. So when President Obama came into office, his view was that the non-proliferation regime, basically the non-proliferation treaty that we use to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, had begun to fray. The United States and Russia weren't necessarily working as cooperatively as they had in the past on nuclear issues. More importantly, more and more nations were beginning to violate their obligations, which are those nations that don't have weapons agree not to pursue them. Those nations that do have weapons, nuclear weapons, agree to work together to reduce their arsenals and eventually work towards a goal of a world without nuclear weapons. So the first step in the president's agenda in dealing with these issues was for the United States and Russia to negotiate a new strategic arms reduction treaty that would reduce our deployed nuclear warheads and launchers and delivery vehicles and enable reductions in our nuclear stockpile. We reached that agreement with the Russians, signed it this week in Prague. We believe it's a very important first step for a number of reasons. First, because, it establishes U.S. and Russian leadership in keeping our own obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty by the reduction of our own arsenals. That both invigorates non-proliferation efforts globally because it allows us to be better positioned to hold other nations to account for their efforts. It, of course, reduces our arsenals, and it establishes the important U.S.-Russian cooperation that is necessary on behalf of non-proliferation efforts, because as the two countries with 95% of the world's nuclear weapons, the U.S. and Russia have a responsibility, really, to lead here. To your question as to why nuclear weapons still exist, what President Obama has said is that as long as there are nuclear weapons, we are not going to unilaterally disarm. We're not going to give up the nuclear deterrent that we and our allies depend upon for our own security. And so that therefore, as we pursue these reductions, and as we go down the long road towards a world without nuclear weapons, we'll have to negotiate further reductions in concert with other nations. And that will be a step-by-step process. The first step, of course, was this treaty with the Russians. But we're going to have to go further in pursuing reductions, for instance, with Russia, as the president said the other day, and eliminating some of our deployed and non-deployed weapons. And eventually, we're going to have to work in concert with the international community and many nations to reduce nuclear weapons. So this is a long-term process. As the president said, it's an ambitious goal that may not even be reached in his lifetime to eliminate all nuclear weapons. But as we pursue that goal, we make the world more secure by reducing the number of weapons, by securing those arsenals so they can't fall into the wrong hands, and by keeping our commitments under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the mechanism that we use to prevent other nations from acquiring nuclear weapons and holding them to account if they fail to live up to their obligations.
Okay, so to follow on your answer about Russia, Lev, and his last name is, I don't know how to pronounce it, so we'll just say Lev on Facebook, touched on some big news that came out yesterday about Ukraine.
Yeah.
And asked, how is the relationship between Ukraine and the USA different than between the USA and Russia?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I'd say a number of things. First of all, Ukraine has been a leader, really, in the area of non-proliferation for many years. At the end of the Cold War, Ukraine, for instance, in 1994, I believe, agreed to give up the nuclear weapons that were on its territory. And those moved back to Russia. Yesterday, what they announced is that the stockpiles of high-enriched uranium which are the materials that would be used to build a nuclear bomb, that those two, they would transport off of their territory on behalf of global nuclear security by the time of the next nuclear summit, which is in 2012 in South Korea. And the United States agreed to provide some financial and technical assistance in making that possible. I'm sure Russia will be an important part of this effort as well. As it relates to the relationship bilaterally between the United States and Ukraine, Ukraine has a new president, President Yanukovych. Yesterday was the first opportunity for President Obama to meet with him. We believe that this effort in particular is indicative of the kind of strong partnership that we have with Ukraine and that we want to continue to develop with the new Ukrainian administration. It shows a sense of cooperation around an important issue. But I think as it relates to nuclear security broadly, that this is something that this summit underscores is a task for many nations. And Russia will be a critical part of that, because you can't have effective nuclear security unless the United States and Russia are working together in concert, and unless nations like Ukraine are also working on a multilateral basis, not just a bilateral basis with the United States, but Ukraine working with the United States, with Russia, and with the international community more broadly. Because again, these materials are in many different countries. So the United States and Russia have a special kind of leadership that we're continuing to develop, not just through the START Treaty, but through a very important plutonium disposition agreement that we're finalizing today with Russia. But we'll work on a multilateral basis with Ukraine and with many nations here today. So I think that yesterday's announcement was a positive signal about the kind of bilateral relationship that the United States has with Ukraine and the president has with the new Ukrainian president. But it also speaks to a multilateral set of relationships on behalf of national security, nuclear security, that includes Russia, the Ukraine, the United States, and the 47 nations that are here today.
Great. So Ava Marie George on Facebook asked a question that a lot of folks are asking. How can we monitor the stockpile of nuclear weapons and maintain security of our country when foreign countries have nuclear capability without direct observation 24/7, 365? My concern is not about the countries who agree to this kind of monitoring. My concern is for those countries who do not give one single thought to blowing up the planet to prove a psychotic point, political, religious, or other. How can we assure compliance if every country continues to produce those very supplies that are being used to build these dirty bombs?
It's an interesting question, of course, and a fundamental question. I'd say two things. You have the nations that are coming together, for instance, here today. And a lot of that, the agreements that are being forged today and the work plan that is being developed today speaks to your question, which is how does the international community have assurance that those nuclear materials and stockpiles that exist are secure? What kind of international effort is there, for instance, through the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to ensure that the international community can be confident that nuclear materials, nuclear stockpiles are secure? And so what is being developed today essentially is a series of, in some cases, nations giving up their nuclear material altogether, as we've seen in a number of instances. Ukraine, Canada, Mexico, Chile recently shipped its HEU, high enriched uranium, to the United States. But in addition to those nations giving up those materials, you also see nations signing on to essentially either international, specific international efforts related to the IAEA and other monitoring mechanisms, and also a series of best practices as it relates to nuclear security, so that the nations of the world can share the best ways in which they secure their own materials. Then there's a second category of nations. In particular, I think the ones that you're alluding to, which might be those nations like Iran, for instance, that are in violation of their non-proliferation obligations, that are perhaps developing a nuclear weapons capability and a nuclear weapons program outside of the non-proliferation treaty. And we have reason to believe through Iran's behavior that they, number one, continue to fail to live up to their obligations under the NPT, and that suggests their pursuit of a nuclear weapon. And in that instance, that's where the non-proliferation treaty itself becomes so fundamentally important, because the NPT, the non-proliferation treaty, has essentially been able to keep the number of nuclear weapons states relatively low. At the dawn of the Cold War, it was projected that scores of nations would pursue nuclear weapons in the coming years. Because of the NPT, proliferation was largely stemmed over many years. We've seen that fray in recent years as nations like Iran and North Korea have pursued nuclear weapons. So what the president is really focused upon is having an NPT that is reinvigorated and strengthened so that we can hold nations accountable when they don't live up to their obligations. He said, of course, that a nation like Iran has a right under the NPT to peaceful nuclear energy. And if they can demonstrate that their nuclear program is for peaceful purposes, it can be brought into the framework of the NPT, and Iranians can benefit from peaceful nuclear energy. If, however, Iran continues to fail to live up to its obligations under the NPT, they need to be held accountable, which is why the United States, with a coalition of nations, is pursuing a new sanctions resolution at the United Nations to sanction the Iranian government should they continue to fail to live up to their obligations under the NPT. So we believe that in addition to securing nuclear materials, we need to stop the spread of nuclear weapons more broadly. And we believe that by reinvigorating the international efforts around nuclear security and around nonproliferation, we'll be in a far stronger position to hold those nations accountable that do fail to live up to their obligations.
Okay, so I've got three questions for you at once, but they're all pretty similar. But they have to do with the question of, so we want to eliminate them, now what? So let's start with Philip Winter, who asks, Dear Mr. Rhodes, when you were talking about the elimination of nuclear weapons, what will you do with them? Where will you leave them, all the uranium that's left behind? The next one says, how does the government plan to dispose of disarmed nukes? And the final question, more of an economic one, from Kentucky, says, please explain how the U.S. will pay for the protection of uranium. Will the countries giving up the material share in the cost? So how does it all work from an economic standpoint?
I will answer this to the best of my capability. There are colleagues of mine with a far greater scientific knowledge, I think, who can speak more precisely to the way in which some of these materials are disposed of. I think later today, for instance, we're having a briefing with our team here around the summit, who I think can speak with some specificity to these questions. But for instance, I think what you see in many instances is there are certain materials that are most at risk in terms of being transferred into a bomb, in particular plutonium and high-enriched uranium. So for those nations that want to pursue peaceful nuclear energy, this process involves turning those materials, transferring them out of the country, but also providing them with a low-enriched uranium power within their own borders. So, for instance, Mexico, which has agreed to get rid of its high-enriched uranium here today, the power that they have depended upon as it relates to those efforts can come from a different kind of nuclear energy, from low-enriched uranium, so that therefore they can have the benefits of energy without the risk of the materials that are most vulnerable for a bomb. So what we want to get to is an international framework where nations and people can benefit from peaceful nuclear energy without having the accompanying risk of the presence of these kinds of materials on multiple and many places where they could be vulnerable to falling into the wrong hands. So there are many different ways, I think, of disposing of these materials, and some of it is disposing of them, and I think some of it is transitioning them into a different kind of energy that can be harnessed for good, and that frankly over time can have a great economic benefit, because there are economic benefits that come from peaceful nuclear energy. So I'll leave it to those with a far greater aptitude for science than me to speak to the processes with which we dispose of these materials or transition them into other kinds of energy. But the international framework that we're setting up here is intended to do that. And I might add that tomorrow there is also going to be an accompanying summit of private sector companies, because a lot of these nuclear materials, frankly, are not just in the hands of governments, but they involve the management of the private sector. So the private sector is coming together behind a series of security practices that can enhance this effort as well.
Okay. Well, that was a pretty in-depth one, so I'm going to give you an easy one.
Thanks.
Take a break, and then we'll come back
to it. Farther away from science,
we got one from Twitter. The name is XOAMZZ, so I'll leave the pronunciation to everyone out there. But she just says, what's it like working at the Nuclear Security Summit? Can you tell us a little about what's going on here and what it's like for you to be
sure.
here?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, it comes at the end of a very busy 9 days on these issues. 1 year ago, on April 5th, the president gave his Prague speech. And we've kept three commitments of that speech this week. The first was we released a nuclear posture review, which reduced the role of nuclear weapons in America's national security strategy by focusing our deterrent on those nations that don't have nuclear weapons that are not compliant with their NPT obligations. And therefore, those nations that are in compliance with the NPT and don't have nuclear weapons would not be subject to being threatened with America's nuclear arsenal. So that kept the president's commitment to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our security strategy, because we believe in the 21st century, coming out of the Cold War, with terrorists and proliferation being the threat, we can therefore reduce our reliance on nuclear weapons for security. Second is the START Treaty, which Macon mentioned, and we traveled to Prague and had a very exciting event where the president and President Medvedev signed what was really a historic treaty moving forward. And then we came back here to the summit, and I'd say it's been a very busy, busy couple of days, because we've had 47 nations here. And in addition to the massive challenge, and frankly, in some instances, a logistical challenge of facilitating all those nations coming together here at the summit, the president has also done a lot of business on a bilateral basis. I think he's had 10 or 11 meetings, bilateral meetings with other heads of state. So on Sunday, we were over at the Blair House, where the president met with a number of leaders, South Africa, and Pakistan, and India, and Nigeria. And so we were focused on Sunday on these bilateral meetings that the president was holding. On Monday, we moved over here to the Convention Center, which is a huge building. And yesterday, the president continued to have a series of bilateral meetings with a whole range of nations, from Malaysia to Armenia, and on down the list. And then last night at dinner, he kicked off the summit by hosting world leaders here for a dinner where they discussed the threat of nuclear terrorism. And now today is the more formal summit, where they have had two plenary sessions, one in the morning, broke for lunch, and now right now they're in the second and final plenary session. And that's where all of the leaders, 47 heads of delegations, are sitting in a room and discussing these issues. For those of us who are essentially staff at these things, it involves being kind of behind the curtain, as you will, and moving from room to room and making sure that the people we work for, in my instance the president, has all the support he needs, all the materials he needs, and also making sure that the press is informed of what we're doing and that the American people are informed of what we're doing. So there's a whole universe of people here working different aspects of the summit while the leaders are conferring right now in the room. So there's really a massive logistical challenge that goes along with any one of these. We've attended many summits in other countries, G20 and others. We've been up to the UN. But one of the points we made about this particular summit is that this is the largest gathering of foreign leaders that an American president has hosted since 1945, the San Francisco conference that led to the United Nations. And that, I think, speaks to the importance that President Obama places on this issue of nuclear security. And also his belief that in the 21st century, challenges such as this can't be solved by one nation, but must be solved by bringing together many nations to forge the kind of collective action that can enhance American security and global security.
Great. So this will be our last question, but it gets to, let's do two more. I think we have time, but let's start with a pair of questions. The first comes from Alan Batterman, he asks, what constitutes dangerous nuclear material? Would it include nuclear waste from power plants? And the second question is from Morgan Haley, who follows up and says, why do private interests have access to nuclear-grade materials? So can you talk a little bit about how we're defining things here?
Sure. And again, I spoke to this a little bit, but I think I can be a little bit more specific. When it comes to what a terrorist might use, right, there's a range of nuclear materials that are dangerous. I mean, obviously, these are very highly dangerous materials. Now, there's such a thing as a dirty bomb, which you may have heard of, And that may be an instance where radiological materials are packaged with conventional explosives by terrorists and detonated in a way that causes damage and obviously widespread fear in the area that these materials are released. But that doesn't produce a nuclear yield. So it doesn't produce the kind of nuclear explosion, mushroom cloud explosion that we associate with these weapons. So the damage from that would obviously be terrible, but it would not be on the scope of a nuclear explosion. It would instead be radioactive materials being released through a kind of conventional explosion. Then the second and more dangerous materials that we're focused on at this summit are those that can forge a nuclear yield. And that specifically is high-enriched uranium or plutonium. And that through the acquisition of those materials, and of course the process of turning that into a weapon, it's possible to create a nuclear explosion, which of course could kill on the order of tens or hundreds of thousands of people. So the focus of this summit is on the latter, those materials, high-enriched uranium and plutonium, that are the most dangerous because they could lead to literally a nuclear explosion rather than the release of radiological materials. Now, we do have, of course, very aggressive efforts around the dirty bomb threat, but this summit is focused in particular on the threat of those materials that could be used to make a nuclear bomb. And again, we know that Al-Qaeda, for instance, and some other groups have actively pursued that capability. They've tried to buy it, they've tried to acquire it through various means. So the good news is, though, that we know that there's a specific kind of material that is necessary to make that kind of weapon, and that we do believe that that material can be accounted for and secured through the kinds of efforts that we're launching here today, and that it also can be buttressed by the kind of interdiction processes that we pursue now, so that, that we're shutting down any kind of black market trade in these materials. So that I think answers the first question. The second one on the private industry is that there, of course, is a nuclear energy industry. But of course, the nuclear energy industry takes place within regulation and cooperation with national governments. So essentially, you have governments working in concert with industry to ensure the security of what are very dangerous materials.
Okay, so this will be our last question. It comes from Isabel Hutchinson on Facebook, who asks, how can I reassure my family that we are just as safe under this plan as we were before?
Well, I would actually argue that you can reassure your family that that you will be safer as this plan goes forward, because again, there is a fixed amount of this material around the world, and what we want to be able to do is put in place practices where we can account for where it is and where it can be secured and locked down over the course of this four-year period that the president has laid out, and that each step that it's been announced here today to either again eliminate high-enriched uranium, to put in place new security practices, to join new cooperative efforts, is a step towards that goal of securing all of this material, so that we're moving in a positive trajectory to securing those materials that could be used to fall into the wrong hands and to yield a nuclear bomb. So what we've seen here today is a very positive series of steps down the road to locking down all of this material. So the other thing I'd add, though, is, as you mentioned previous plans, this actually invigorates a lot of efforts that already were in place. For instance, after the fall of the Soviet Union, we put in place what is widely known here in the United States as the Nunn-Lugar program, or the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, where the United States worked with Russia and former Soviet republics to try to secure a lot of this material. And that yielded some success. And what we've done is we've wanted to both build on the successes of the past, to find out what worked and to do more of it, and also, though, to create a sense of urgency around this, that we can't move at kind of a slow pace in securing these materials, because we know that terrorist groups are actively seeking them. So this summit was very much about galvanizing a sense of urgency bringing together a wide range of nations, fostering collective action, and also calling upon nations to take individual actions to speed up this process of securing these materials and providing the assurance to someone like you that your family will be more secure from what would be a high consequence threat. And I, just to be clear, the reason we're focused on this is that it is the threat that would have the highest consequence. That doesn't mean that it's the most likely threat to take place. It means that were it to take place, it of course would yield the greatest devastation. So what, by eliminating the materials that are necessary to execute that threat, we believe we can remove from the terrorist, from the broader terrorist threat, what would be the most devastating attack, so that they don't have access to those materials that could lead to more widespread destruction than we've seen in previous terrorist attacks, and that we are constantly being vigilant in reducing that threat, just as we are in trying to dismantle terrorist networks more broadly, so that any kind of terrorist threat is dramatically reduced, and the American people are far more secure. So that's what really this is all about, fostering collective action on the side of keeping the most dangerous weapons away from the most dangerous people, just as we continue to pursue our counterterrorism efforts to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda and its affiliates around the world.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Ben, and thanks for tuning in. This video, in case you missed any of it, will be available at whitehouse.gov later this afternoon. Stay tuned for future chats. Thanks a lot and have a good day.
Thanks.